Stephen Katz is the founding director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies at Boston University. He's a highly regarded and respected thought leader on the subject of Judaism, and he is a returning guest to the Lifeblood podcast. Welcome back, Dr. Katz.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Excited to have you back on. I reached out because I am personally doing an exploration of money from the perspective of the world's largest religions or most practiced religions. And since we had such a wonderful conversation about Judaism a couple of months back, I invited you back on to talk about that. So thanks for coming back on. And what's the best place to start?
I think the best place to start is not with the biblical and classical things, but with how Jews became associated with money. The issue with Jews and money is a peculiar one, and it's deeply entrenched in our culture. And people think about all the time that Jews have money. When you go to China and you give a lecture on anything, you give it on the Bible, on Maimonides, on Zionism, the first question you get is, why are the Jews so smart? And the second question is, why are the Jews so rich? And that's everywhere, this impression of Jews and money. But you have to understand that it's not necessarily the case that this should be so. What happened is a historical accident. People need to understand that in the classical world, there was no special association of Jews and money. Not in the biblical period, not in the post-biblical period, the rabbinic period, not in the early Middle Ages. In those eras, as you see, for example, in a famous collection of documents on Greek and Roman authors on Jews and Judaism, that there is no document that identifies Jews and money in any special way. And you won't find any identification elsewhere in Egyptian sources and other kinds of Middle Eastern sources. So how did it come about that this association got fixed? It happened by accident because of the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, the church controlled the social order, controlled the economic order, controlled political life. And the church increasingly was hostile to Judaism. And so what it did was, it, with the help of kings and cardinals, passed legislation that said Jews can't be part of the regular economy. They can't be part of the guild. They can't go to the universities. They can't learn the usual trades. What can they do to stay alive? Because the church did have a principle to keep Jews alive. It said, we'll put them in areas of the economy that are unwelcome to everyone else. And the most important of these was usury. Now, remember, usury, lending money at interest, is a biblical rule. You shouldn't lend money at interest. And we can come back to talk about that in a few minutes. But in the meanwhile, even though the rule was no lending an interest, society, medieval society, needed interest. No one needed it more than the church and the king. And in fact, the largest money lenders in the Middle Ages were actually the church. But the fact is that to make it widely available to ordinary people, they said, you Jews, you can lend money at interest, even though it was against Jewish law, just like it was against Christian law. But the Jews, having no alternative except being dealers in secondhand rags, took on the opportunity. Now, what happened? No one likes the person you owe money to. And therefore, the anti-Semitism created a role that exacerbated the financial connection as a source of hate. So it plays in two ways. One, anti-Semitism causes usury. I want to stress, the anti-Semitism precedes money lending. Then, because it exists, Jews lend money, and of course, no one likes the money lender, so it reinforces the hatred of Jews. So this becomes an association widespread throughout Christian society. You don't find it the same degree in Muslim society. You don't find it in other parts of the world where the Jews lived, even if they're successful, like in India and China. But the whole idea of the association comes from this peculiar role that Jews are forced to play in the Middle Ages. So when you understand that, then you follow the rest of the story. And you see, for example, by the time of Shakespeare in the end of the 16th century, Shylock, and then you get Fagin with Dickens and so on. So these are historical growth in historical ideas that everyone needs to understand.
I'll just ask the question. Are you aware of beliefs or thoughts around usury and Islam?
There are principles, but they're not developed the same way. You don't have the same body of literature till the modern era. What happens in Islam is that Islam has its own reasons for anti-Judaism. It's in competition over the question of who has the real privilege with God, Jews, Christians, or Muslims. The Muslims decreed that the Muslims are superior, and that's why they call the Quran the seal of the prophets. He closes the book of prophecy. No one can compete. And the earlier traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Zoroastrianism are all true, but inferior. And so they're called dhimmis, which means protected minorities. But to get the protected status, they have to pay special taxes and have other kinds of restrictions. So they can't ride a horse, only a donkey. They can't build a synagogue higher than a mosque. They can't have other certain kinds of financial activity. They must wear clothes with yellow garb, yellow in them, which is where the Nazi idea of a yellow star comes from. So Islam has a different tradition. There's a more theological tradition.
Thank you. You mentioned that there is no document or writing that existed around Jews and money. Did I get that
in the
right?
Classical period.
Okay.
By the Middle Ages, of course, you have it because this has all unfolded, begun to grow in its reach. But if you look at Greek authors, if you look at Latin authors, you won't find this as a symbol, a mark of antipathy to the Jews. You don't find any of that. Later on, it's always a question of Jews and money becomes part of a larger conversation of anti-Semitism. There's classical anti-Semitism, and it's mostly misanthropic. The charge that Jews are not like other people because they have a special Sabbath, special food laws. They don't enter into sexual relations with non-Jews, supposedly. But the economic argument you don't find. So this is a medieval development.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the context very much. In terms of... So in the Torah, is there talk about the pursuit of wealth, the pursuit of money, just the feelings about being wealthy?
There is in the Torah, the five books of Moses, conversation, minor conversation, I'd say, about economic matters. But there's no real discussion of money, the way we think of money today. What they think of is that there are economic interests that people have. And there are economic interactions that people have. And what the Torah is concerned to do is to set down rules that make these interactions fair and honorable. The key is that there should be a social order that is harmonious and honorable. So you think, for example, there's a rule that you have to pay your workers every day. So you really pay them. The other place you see it, for example, is in the Jubilee year. You know the rules of the Jubilee year, George?
I do not.
Every 7 years, there's a sabbatical year. The land lies fallow. Every 49th year, every cycle of seven sevens, you get the 50th year, which is called the Jubilee year. You have in Philadelphia, I think, the famous phrase about the Jubilee year on the house of the Revolutionary Assembly. The fact is that in the 50th year, all land transactions, all the buying and selling of land, all the rearrangement of land, returns to the original biblical division of the land. Now, why does the Bible want that to be the case? Because it understands that in the course of the 49 intervening years, there will be dislocations. Some people will get rich, some people will get poor, some people would be advantaged, others disadvantaged. But they didn't want a society that was unjust and had rich and poor, those who have it and those who haven't had it. And therefore, the Bible legislates in the 50th year, it goes back to zero, so that everybody starts off again in what Moses had done by dividing the land fairly. So you see, there are rules that are largely responsible to the community. They're about the responsibility you have if you have resources, but there's no discussion of money as such.
What is the significance of the number seven?
Seven is an old idea that seven is a cosmological influence. You know, there's an old theory that numbers and letters have significance and that they tell you certain kinds of things. And also, they lend themselves to a certain kind of creative power, magic, whatever you might call it. So, if you study Genesis, you'll find that in the creation story, seven is already very important. 7 days of the week, 7 days having to do with other forms. If you count, you'll find counts of 49, seven times seven. So seven is associated with magical ideas, not with money.
Fair enough. So after seven periods of seven, so 49 years, the idea being that over the course of that time, some will rise, some will fall, bad things will happen, good things will happen, and we need to reset things to foster fairness.
Right.
Is
That's
that still
the idea.
practiced?
No, it hasn't been practiced. We don't know if it was ever practiced, but it's the biblical rule. The time it would have been practiced in would have been in the First Temple period, which was from the 10th century to the 6th century, before the Common Era, before Christianity. But it's contested whether it ever actually was implemented.
In terms of where we are at today, so just contemporary Jewish life, how is money thought about from a community standpoint, if at all?
Well, it's thought about, I think, very much under the influence of the tradition, namely that God is the source of wealth. And if God gives you wealth, it's not for you to squander and just be a playboy. The idea is that you have responsibility to use that wealth for the good of the community. And here you see a very strong emphasis in Jewish tradition on charity. That charity is not a whimful, just I want to do it, I don't want to do it. It's mandated. Remember the biblical rules about tithing, that you should give 10% of your income. And when you deal with money, you shouldn't think of lending money as a source of making money. You should do these things as a kind of human solidarity. And more locally, more especially, to reinforce the nature of the Jewish community so that, for example, everywhere you look, every festival, for example, goes very far in the discussion of what's obligated that you should give charity at the beginning of the festival. You should open your doors to invite the hungry into your Passover meal or your other festive meals. That you have great responsibility to see for the children, the orphans. You all know, everyone knows about the biblical account that repeatedly says, repeatedly, many, many times, you have to look after the widow and the orphan. Then you have the rules that are famous to most people because they are prominent in the story of Ruth, who becomes the great grandmother of Jesus. And she's organizing agricultural gatherings. She goes out into the field, and you see there the rule. The rule of the agricultural law is that there's a certain percentage of the field you have to leave alone. You can't cut and take it because you have to leave it for the poor so they'll have what to be fed on. They'll have enough to live on. So there are these ideas of maintenance of community responsibility. I remember even as a child, when we went to the school, the traditional school, before we prayed in the morning, we would put a few pennies in a charity box. In every traditional Jewish home, one of the things you'll find is a charity box called a tzedakah box. So this is the traditional idea, George.
Excellent. I am certainly not any kind of a biblical scholar, being raised Episcopalian. That's
Well, I
sort of my
will forgive
motivation
you.
for this exploration to learn more. But I recall a verse in the Bible talking about how it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Is there anything like that in the Jewish faith?
No, that's a Christian statement. That's a statement in the New Testament. I would say that the rabbis did not look favorably on spending one's life trying to get rich. On the other hand, they certainly did not see it as a criminal activity. And they believed that the right thing is how you use it. It's a temptation. It's a tool. It's an obligation. It's many things. And the trick for human beings is to negotiate which ones are right and which ones are wrong, which ones are helpful and which ones are devastating, destructive, which ones are honorable and which ones are not honorable.
That's the trick.
That's the trick.
So I'm hearing themes of responsibility, community, stewardship, giving, tithing. Is there a certain amount that is ex is the term ex is it
Yes.
expectation?
It's not an expectation, it's a requirement that you should give 10% of your yearly income to charity. And then there are discussions of how much above that you can give away, because if you give away too much, you just become poor, someone will have to feed you. So it all starts, however, with the biblical obligation that everyone has to give 10% of their income, tithing. Also, when the temple stood in Jerusalem, there were a requirement for the general good that everybody in the community also sent every year a certain fixed sum of money into the treasury so that the temple could do good works, give out charity, keep the sacrificial order going, and so on.
I know I live in Arizona, and we have a very vibrant Jewish community, and I've heard of the Jewish free loan. Are you
Right.
familiar with that?
Sure, that's an old cut. Remember, I told you that you have usury in the Bible and it's viewed negatively. And it says that you shouldn't lend money at interest, right? Usury doesn't just mean lending money, it means lending money at interest. So here you have a situation just like the medieval Christian community needed interest and put the Jews in the role. The Jewish community everywhere realized that you need interest to help the poor, to help a businessman who may try to get started, to help a widow and an orphan. So what it says is that you can help the community by creating a fund that you can give out, help all the people in need, but not charge them any interest. So you give out $100 and hopefully they pay you back 100. And the next person comes in and gets the 100, uses it again. It's very interesting that in Asia, there are a lot of places where women have discovered the secret, and they've created these kind of communes where they collectively take money to help people buy a sewing machine or some other kind of necessity. Then they make some local currency and they repay the loan to the organization of women. That old idea in Judaism goes back already to late rabbinic times, rabbinic, that is say 200, 300, 100. It's a very ancient idea.
And a very beautiful one, and
It's a
the
very
example.
nice idea. Free loan societies everywhere. Wherever you have a Jewish community, you'll find you have it.
What is the thinking, feeling, practice, requirements, responsibilities around leaving an inheritance to future generations?
Well, there are rules again in the Bible. Obviously, there's a practical matter. And again, the Bible is concerned about how it should be done fairly. So the Bible does talk about distributing estates. It talks about inheritance. And what it does is simply say that there should be no fighting. Everybody should know the rules. The oldest child gets a double portion. That's the main rule. And the other children then divide equally what's left of the assets.
Is the primacy of the firstborn.
Primacy of the firstborn, that's right.
Why is that?
Well, they felt that that was the nature of the biblical tradition, that the oldest child had a kind of preeminence. And so they continued that. And you see the same thing in royal families in Europe, right? Who becomes the king? The oldest son. And then his brother follows him in due course if he passes away. But the idea is that there's something about primogeniture, there's something about the firstborn having rights.
Do you have a favorite story or
I
scripture?
thought of that. You asked in advance. I couldn't think of a story. I'm not much of a storyteller, George. I'm a historian. So I'm going to give that a miss.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Historian versus storyteller. The
Yeah, you know.
power of narrative.
Well, storytellers might do more good, but again, they're not held to the same standard of accuracy.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
And remember,
Excellent.
most of the stories you hear anyway are really kind of hagiography. They're usually told to extol someone, and it's not clear at all that the story has any basis in fact.
Fair enough. I know that you've shared a lot of wisdom and information with us, and I'm grateful for that. What have I forgotten to ask that you think is important about this conversation?
I think the important thing is that what has happened is this association of Jews and money has become so deeply ingrained in the cultural life of Western Europe, especially, and spread from there now in significant ways to the Muslim world, where the anti-Semitism of Christianity was imported in the 19th and 20th centuries because of Zionism and other kinds of competition. And the most terrible thing is that it distorts the reality of Jewish life, and it distorts the reality of Jewish and non-Jewish interactions, and it creates all kinds of mythic, stereotypical misunderstandings that can have only negative consequences and that are untrue.
Going back to that, the problem of storytelling.
Right.
There
In Arizona, you can tell stories.
you go. I like it. Well, Dr. Stephen Katz, thank you so much for coming back on and sharing your insights and knowledge and wisdom with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, George.
If you enjoyed this as much as I did, show Dr. Katz your appreciation and share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. And remember, do your part by doing your best.
Thank you.